Good evening and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. Tonight's program is presented in partnership with the Lafayette Library and Learning Center's Glenn Seaborg Learning Consortium. You can find the club online at commonwealthclub.org. I'm Stephen Falk, Lafayette City Manager, and your moderator for tonight's program. It's now my pleasure to introduce our distinguished guest, Donald Vandermark, a former news anchor at CNN and CNBC-TV, and the author of The Good Among the Great. Donald has been a television reporter and anchorman, an internet entrepreneur, and a public speaker. He launched his career in 1981 in New York City, where he was a desk assistant at WCBS-TV News. From there, he joined the Business Times on ESPN. He spent 5 years in Washington, D.C., reporting on the political economy as the national correspondent for CNBC, and he worked for Barry Diller at QVC. In the 1990s, Donald was instrumental in the launch of the first digital non-linear television network, CNN-FN. There, he co-created and anchored 4 original television shows, Washington Unwrapped, The Media Show, Biz Buzz, and Entrepreneurs Only. With Terry Keenan, Donald also co-anchored and edited CNN-FN's premier market program, Street Sweep. Additionally, he co-anchored Money Week on CNN. On August 31, 1998, Donald broke the story of long-term capital management's near collapse, an event that shook global currency, bond, and equity markets. Among his television credits, Donald was executive producer and host of 2 public broadcasting TV series, Great Entrepreneurs and Great Leaders, where he profiled giants of business, including Andy Grove of Intel, Jack Welch of General Electric, Martha Stewart, Stephen Covey, and many more. And so I would like you to give a nice warm welcome to Donald Vandermark.
Thank you for having me. I am fascinated in this subject, not only because I've interviewed all these great characters in politics and business, but because in my own life, I learned as a boy and then as a young man that there are certain personality traits that wonderful people have, and they often don't even know it, that they have them, but it makes their lives much better. It makes them much more productive. It makes them much more loving and able to receive love. And I learned this because as a kid, my own family, my parents divorced. There was a long struggle between my mother and father. I was sent to a boarding school along with my siblings. But every summer I went back to one place in Canada on a lake, beautiful place, and there were a series of families there that had been prosperous and happy for generations. And I wanted to know why. It always struck me, who are these people? How do they do it? Generation after generation. Not that everyone in that group was so successful, but most of them were, and as a group they were. And they handed down not just property and great ideas about life, but just a way of being. So I was always curious about why some people are given the exact same opportunities, and they succeed wonderfully, and others don't. So then I went into the news business as I got out of college, and I started interviewing characters. I moved to Washington. I was interviewing politicians. And then I was in New York interviewing all sorts of finance kingpins, queenpins, if you like to. And then I moved out here to California, and I was with this website, a little media company called MyPrimeTime.com, and we were focused on personal and professional development. We were focused on baby boomers, that age group, and that just happens to be the age that a lot of us reassess our lives and try to redirect where we're headed more to our own liking. And so it was a good audience, and part of that was also some television production, Great Entrepreneurs and Great Leaders. And out here, talking to entrepreneurs more than any other group, politicians, CEOs, finance types, finally entrepreneurs, there was a hotbed of wonderful people. Entrepreneurs as a class are mavericks. They're creative, and they tend to care about more than money. So I was dealing with high-achieving individuals who were not just in it for money, power, and fame, shall we say. Often they just wanted to build a better mousetrap, as they say, make the world better for the rest of us. And after I'd interviewed enough of these characters, I had a list of personality traits, about 15 of them. And at about that time, I was doing research on all the great self-help gurus. Stephen Covey, I actually profiled in a television show, who wrote The 7 Habits of Highly Effective People. How many of you have read that book? Yeah. It's a great book. He's a great guy. You know, it was the only self-help book that was ever on the curriculum of the Harvard Business School, first year, because people found it so valuable. But there was this list of traits, and one of the other persons I was studying besides Stephen Covey and Deepak Chopra and a variety of characters was the late, great 20th century psychologist, Abraham Maslow. And I'll show you a picture of Maslow in a second. But Maslow posited that some people are much healthier than others, 1% of the population. He said we're particularly strong psychologically. And then he outlined a list of 19 specific personality traits that he said basically was the definition of superior health psychologically. Think of these as the athletes in terms of how they behave, how they are, not just how they behave. Now, this is a list of individuals who are actually in the book, and some of these faces you recognize, right? The person in the middle, the black and white photograph, that's Meryl Streep. She's the subject of the epilogue because I think she is someone who's demonstrated all 19 of these traits in a very public way for decades. And usually when I bring up her name, people go, oh, I love her. And it's not just that they love her acting ability or her performances. They've seen a little bit of her in interviews or an award show, and they know that there is a truly remarkable person there, not full of herself, deeply private. That's one of the traits of marvelous people, is that they prize their privacy. She has empathy for others. She's very involved in a variety of charitable organizations around the world. She has charted her own path and her own career in a variety of ways. I won't go on and on about Meryl Streep, but you know what I'm talking about. Another individual, Charles Schwab, bottom, second from the right, who's a San Franciscan. I think actually he grew up out here in the East Bay. I interviewed him, and I said, why did you start this discount brokerage business? You know, and usually you get some fol-de-rol. He said simply, I didn't think Wall Street was empathizing with the small investor. So I really felt this very strong empathy for the small investor, period. One of the traits of marvelous people is that they empathize with others. That was the moment where I thought Maslow really was on to something. This is the book. That's the design, just so you know. This is very abstract. This is what current designers do these days. I added the halo just to make it a little more obvious. Here's the first 10 of the 19 traits. We're going to be able to talk after I speak for about half an hour or 25 minutes, and you can ask questions about any one of these. Number 7, for instance, experiential. People say, I don't know. What do you mean? Really marvelous people aren't just curious. No, they are. But they actually try things. There's a big difference between watching someone ski down a mountain and then skiing down a mountain, right? All my favorite friends are always trying new things. Number 10, this is a marvelous one. Marvelous people are process as well as performance oriented. They know how to take a dream, turn it into a goal, lay out a strategy to reach a goal. That's being performance oriented. At the same time, they do not sacrifice their day-to-day lives on some horrible effort to get to their goal. they make sure that their day-to-day lives are also enjoyable. So they're process-oriented. The story in the book is about Muriel Mafra, who's a great ballerina with the San Francisco Ballet. She's retired from there. But she was told at 16 that she was a beautiful plant, but she cannot dance. This is what the Paris Opera told her. And if you've ever seen her perform, she's just a phenomenal creature on stage. And she just decided, well, I'm going to dance for myself because I love dance. And she turned inward as a teenage girl and not really able to communicate very well verbally, only through movement. And she defied all the critics. 11 through 19. Really marvelous people are dutiful, number 14. And by that I mean they are problem-focused. They're not focused on themselves. And because they're often very talented, very capable, they tend to take on large responsibilities, even sometimes when they don't want to, but they feel an obligation, they feel a duty to do so. And the funnest one is number 18, they happen to be happier than the rest of us. If we have time, I'll have a brief clip of a woman named Shelley Lazarus, who started in the advertising business not long after the Mad Men days, and she ended up running Ogilvy & Mather, one of the largest advertising giants in the world. For 14 years, she was the CEO. And she laughs. She says, I stumbled my way to the top. There was no great plan. I just did what I wanted to do. I did what I love to do. It's a great lesson. Okay, we're going to talk quickly about two of these traits, two very different ones. One is being profoundly realistic. This is the most important trait if you want money, power, and fame. Earthbound success, success narrowly defined. Really, really marvelous human beings, but also just capable people, are usually wedded to reality. Because you can't make good decisions if you're fooling yourself, if you don't have good information, if you aren't keeping your mental windshield clean, as one of my best friends puts it. The second trait we're going to look at is being autonomous. This is the foundation trait, chapter one in the book. Really marvelous human beings have self-directed lives. They know who they are. They know what they want. They go after it. Okay, I talked a little bit earlier about Abraham Maslow. There he is. He died young, unfortunately. He was getting to this type of research when he was about this age. He died at the age of 60 in 1970. And he was beginning to interview college students, and he was culling the healthiest psychologically through a number of ways, and then finding out how they behaved and what they thought about different things. And he was just getting into this, but he at least got to describe theoretically for us these 19 traits. And my book, I hope, in many ways proves that, because you have these marvelous characters, many of them famous, describing in often unprompted ways each of these traits. Okay, reality. This is what Maslow had to say about it. Marvelous people have a superior perception of reality. It's fresher, more efficient, penetrating, more apt to perceive what is there rather than their own wishes, hopes, fears, anxieties, their own theories and beliefs, or those of their cultural group. Now, that's a lot. More efficient is the one I always focus on. My best friends, when I have an issue I'm struggling with, I mean, some important shift in a career or some struggle I'm having with someone or some situation, it's not usually more than a few minutes and a few questions before they've gotten to the nut of the issue I'm facing. And I may have been struggling with it for days or weeks or months. So this is one reason how they achieve so much. They have an efficiency of cognition. They set aside themselves so they're not stuck in their own hopes, fears, wishes, anxieties. We all know people when they start describing things, we know that, okay, they're deluded or they're in denial. Really marvelous people sink into what's real, and they do it often with great courage. And we do it Here's what most of us do. We are predictably irrational. And it's changing a lot of our social sciences right now because we're finally recognizing how irrational human beings are. This is from Dan Ariely from The Social Animal, which is David Brooks's great book, just came out this year. He's a psychologist doing research on how we behave, how we make decisions, what we believe, how we fool ourselves. Quote, "We are pawns in a game whose forces we largely fail to comprehend. We think of ourselves in the driver's seat. This perception has more to do with our desires, with how we want to view ourselves, than with reality." How many of you read The Road Less Traveled? Okay, about a third of you. That was on the New York Times bestseller list for more than a decade back in the 80s by a psychiatrist named Scott Peck. His quote is, "Mental health is an ongoing process of dedication to reality at all costs." Most of us can't do that. We don't have the courage. We don't have the courage to divorce the alcoholic spouse. We don't have the courage to turn in our boss who's acting illegally. We don't have the courage to face up to lies from politicians. And I'm afraid that we do this on a national basis. And we'll get to a couple of examples in a second. But, you know, we went to war in Iraq for a couple of reasons that were blatantly erroneous. And it's very clear now that the evidence that was given to us was, if not mistakenly pulled together, it was forced into the public domain as evidence when it really wasn't. Here's another aspect of how they see reality. Marvelous people. It's penetrating. The superiority in the perception of reality eventuates in a superior ability to reason, to perceive the truth, to come to conclusions, to be logical, and to be cognitively efficient in general. An unusual ability to detect the spurious, the fake, and the dishonest in personality. What an advantage. Really capable people who are wedded to reality see through you and me. I have a friend. He's one of the most successful private equity guys in the country. He married my first girlfriend, who's a wonderful girl from New Orleans. She and I dated when we were 13 at this summer place in Canada. And he and I were talking about how he's hiring these MBAs and how he's hiring all these what they call quant jocks. For any of you who understand finance, you may know the expression, these young men and women who are brilliant in math and all these equations and understanding accounts in businesses and running algorithms. They're the people running Wall Street right now. He said, "I want people who are also socially adept, who are emotionally strong, who can see what's going on in a negotiation, who understand what's not being said." And I said, "Well, what about your wife?" He said, "Oh, she can spot a fraud a block away." That's what being wedded to reality and being focused on cleaning your windshield will help you do. Now, who knows who Charlie Munger is? Okay, about eight of you. Charlie Munger is the vice chairman of Berkshire Hathaway. He's Warren Buffett's sidekick, if you will. He's in his 80s. He's one of the foremost lawyers, actually, in the country. He launched a firm in Southern California called Munger & Tolles. He doesn't practice law now. He really is busy enough with Berkshire Hathaway. He harps on this subject. He was asked once by a woman at a dinner party if he could distill in one word the reason for his and Warren's success. What would it be? And Charlie likes to talk, so it was very hard for him to put in one word. And he finally spat out the word rational, which at its core is about being realistic, about taking the facts in front of you and acting without emotion, without being distorted by your own emotional background. He says that he and Warren, when they're choosing CEOs for the wide variety of businesses that they have, railroads, jet engines, all sorts of things, he said the thing we look for most is good reality recognition. Now, what strikes me most about the subject is that most of us think that our perceptions are reality. And the most capable people in the world work hard at it. And the rest of us don't. The irony is they're better at it because they work at it. They have less confidence in their own ability to see things clearly. This happens on a national scale. Do you remember the Soviet Union, the mighty, powerful Soviet Union, for which we were constantly armed with ICBMs, huge budgets in the military? It was a house of cards. And when it came tumbling down as rapidly as it did, without much in the way of violence or armed insurrection or anything, it was clear. And the reason, the way we should have known is, there was a book written called The Russians by Hedrick Smith, a New York Times bureau chief in Moscow in the 70s. His daughter went to my high school, and so I read the book then. In this wonderful book about the Russian people, he told a lot of the jokes that they tell. And so many of them were at the expense of the government. One of my favorites from the book was a Russian telling Hedrick Smith, "We pretend to work and they pretend to pay us." If we had just listened to the jokes, so that's one tip about recognizing reality. Pay very close attention to the critical humor. I think it's the reason why the Colbert Report and the Daily Show and these comedy programs have become such important vehicles for real information. In the political realm, really important policy debates are actually carried on under the guise of comedy, because comedy is often right there about truth, turning the distortions that we all pretend to buy into and exposing them. I'm running out of time. I love the subject. I talk too long, but we'll do another couple of minutes and then we'll do questions. I want to have just one person from this area, and that's Andy Grove, who is the Hungarian chemical engineer, actually, who helped launch Intel. And he was very testy when I sat down to interview him. He was being dragged down the hall of Intel. He was the CEO at the time. This is 2001. And he sat down, and you could tell he was so busy he didn't really want to spend time with me. But within about 15 minutes, he had opened up like a book, talked about his childhood. He and his mother escaped the Nazis by taking on the identity of Gentiles and heading into the countryside, running from the Red Army as they moved into Hungary during the 50s and the crackdown that the Soviet Union had over the Eastern Bloc. And I started asking him about reality recognition, this sort of subject matter. And it's amazing because these people open up like books. This is the stuff they care about. And he said, first and foremost, it's about, well, I'll let him describe it.
You have to immerse yourself like a sponge into the environment and make yourself available to be influenced by people who want to influence you, who need to influence you. So each of these decisions properly has to be preceded by a period of absorption.
Now, I don't know if you could tell through that thick accent. He's talking about big decisions in your life, in his case, very big decisions about the future of a major corporation, have to be preceded by a period of absorption. And then he sort of says dismissively, listening, if you wish. It's more than listening. Really marvelous people are good animals, so their sensory perceptions are more awake than the rest of ours. So he is very highly attuned to the discussions going on in his business. He worked out of a cubicle along with several hundred other engineers. He ate lunch in the lunchroom where everyone else ate lunch when he was CEO, because he wanted to be in that. He wanted to hear the people who need, who want, and need to hear you. That's where the information is. So each of us has to be open to those people around us, particularly those we admire, those we respect, and the feedback they're willing to give us. Because often they have all the information we need. Okay, quickly, absorbing data. The first thing we all have to do is shut up. My mother hated that expression, but be quiet. We have to be a well, not a fountain. Too many of us simply repeat ourselves instead of stopping. Pay attention to events that challenge your assumptions. Remember the scientific method. What is the scientific method? double-blind study, and then study the data. That's the only way you know if something is efficacious, if it's truly working. Listen to the critical jokes. Remember that everything is changing. What worked for you or your perception of what was going on 5 years ago, sometimes even just 5 months ago, is probably not correct anymore, particularly with the way technology is changing, the way the world is getting smaller. And Charlie Munger and Warren Buffett throw away one of their most cherished investment assumptions every year. They choose one and attack it. The worst investment for about 180 years was railroads. And Warren and Charlie just bought the largest railroad in America. And it's been a great investment for them so far. Because energy prices were rising so much that railroads happened to be a very efficient, if very old-fashioned way of transporting goods, particularly raw materials. So if they are willing to challenge an assumption they hold dear every year, we all should be. I don't know how much time I have. Someone tell me. Steve, should I keep going or should we take questions? 35 minutes left. All right, I'm going to tell one more story, just because I have two brothers on videotape. They're interesting to listen to, on this issue of listening, absorbing data, being more realistic and thus being a better decision maker. Steve Case is the co-founder of AOL, and he had a genius moment back in the 70s, playing with a computer, when a computer was really just for geeks. The blinking lights, the data flows, you know, the silly paper mache things you would do on a printer with a computer. He realized then that the computer was really about communication, community, and that it ought to be tasked so that everyone in this room can talk to their family in distant locations, share video and photographs, and communicate cheaply, and all the rest of it. So that's how he bet on AOL. Now, why was he able to see into the future? I asked his brother, Dan Case, who ran Chase H&Q, Hambrecht & Quist, San Francisco-based bank, about Steve, his brother. And often when you ask these personal questions of these business leaders and others, they stiff arm you. 3 out of 4 of them just duck and dodge the questions. The marvelous people open up because they have less to hide. They have more integrated personalities. Remember, they're healthier. So I asked this question of Dan Case about Steve, half expecting him to stiff arm me, and he jumps right into it. Participate and watch. So Steve Case was the kind of guy who was in the band but also watching, like a coach and a player. And the reason I know this is because at AOL his nickname was The Wall. Blank. In a major meeting, in interviews with new employees, senior employees, people could not read his mind. He didn't give back, emote the way the rest of us do. And the reason was wide open, just the way Andy Grove was describing. When I asked Steve Case about it, I half expected him to stiff arm me as well. But this is what he had to say.
Sort of being able to soak things up, just sort of, it's almost like a pattern recognition kind of experiment. Just hearing this, reading this, seeing that, thinking that, being able to kind of connect the dots. Maybe they're not so easily connectable. And that is kind of having a pulse to what's happening.
And having an idea of what's going to happen in the future. And that's a major advantage when you're an entrepreneur. All right, I'm going to stop here, and I'll welcome your questions on the issue of being autonomous and any of the other traits, and we'll take questions.
All right, you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. Our speaker today is Donald Vandermark, author of The Good Among the Great, who is discussing the personality traits shared by super high achievers that allow them to remain great human beings as well. Well, Donald, I will say I enjoyed reading your book on my Kindle. I won't have you autograph it this afternoon over the last few days. And I've got a number of questions that have been submitted by the audience. I've got some of my own. And let me just start with this observation. You refer in your book to the good people, the best people. But doesn't that imply that the other 99% aren't good?
No.
And what makes one person better than another?
Well, it's hard, you know, this word successful and better and whatnot. Some people have their own definitions of that, and they often mean, okay, he's richer or she's more powerful or they've excelled further. The book is really attempting to describe a successful life, a really whole human being. The people I'm describing have wonderful families generally, and they are very involved in their communities. Charles Schwab has donated tens of millions, maybe hundreds of millions, to a variety of charities, but a lot of them about dyslexia, because he's dyslexic. So he has spearheaded all these great organizations and efforts to help kids with learning disabilities. Every one of these characters is involved in all sorts of wonderful ways in an outward fashion. They're outwardly focused. So when I'm talking about the top 1%, I'm simply talking about those who are demonstrating 12 or 14 or 15 traits on a regular basis, and maybe even 19 on a long-term basis, such as Meryl Streep. It may mean that the rest of us are demonstrating 8 of the traits on a regular basis and the other ones only periodically. I know I struggle with being autonomous, about really being self-accepting and having a self-directed life. And we each struggle with a variety of them. But the good news is, as soon as you recognize these and read about them and understand them, you can be more that way, and then each one helps the other one. It's not like you have to do one and then, oh boy, there are 18 others. As soon as you are one of these traits, like being egalitarian, it helps you also be more realistic. If you're more egalitarian, you're looking at each individual without getting stuck on the superficial, the fact that someone is a woman or a certain age or a certain race. You're seeing through to the spirit within. That will get you a lot more information about that person. It'll help you make better decisions. It makes you more realistic. It makes you empathize, better able to empathize, which is another trait. So they all fold and support each other.
So talk for a moment about nature versus nurture then, and this this question about whether people are born good, are they born with these traits, or are they something that can be learned?
Nature matters. Your DNA definitely matters. I don't think any of us can deny that. Some of us are larger, stronger, healthier, and I think that in terms of our personalities, we are also imbued with certain talents and certain fears and foibles and weaknesses. So that does matter. Nurturing matters. Your upbringing matters intensely. And not just your parents, but your siblings and your friends and the community you're in, your culture that you're in. The fact that we're in America, which is a free country ruled by law, you know, is a huge advantage. However, there's also a third element, which is critical, which is choice. You have millions of choices in your life. And this is where the book is focused. You can choose to be more like these people, to learn more about a better way to behave and be. You can choose to bring marvelous people into your life. You can choose to associate with not such great people. And that's what can make the difference, particularly for adults. It's not a panacea. I am not one of these self-help gurus who is promising you the world. I'm simply bringing you some of the most marvelous characters alive. And I talk about historic figures as well. But I'm letting them tell you why and how they do the things they do and why they are the way they are. And to me, it adds up to this marvelous roadmap to a better life.
So one member of the audience asks, can one learn these qualities and yet stay authentic? And to use your own frame, can one learn these qualities and stay autonomous?
Yes. because these qualities are going to enhance your authenticity, your autonomy. They are not going to detract from it. If you're experiential, you are going to ignite all sorts of reactions and emotional responses to all sorts of events that you might not have done beforehand. And it will be you who's on that ski slope or giving a speech or learning to swim or whatever you've chosen not to do but have had some curiosity about. So that's just one trait. But all of them will make you more yourself, not less.
Have you interviewed anybody who you initially thought was a good amongst the great, but then later determined to be a fake?
I've interviewed a lot of finance guys. And I have to tell you that as a class, they're sharks. Now, they're not. I'm not saying that they're doing illegal things, but they are like heat-seeking missiles when it comes to money and crafting deals and buying and selling assets. And that's really what they're all about. In some respects, they're one-dimensional. Now, what happens often is that they become very, very successful and they have all sorts of money, and another side of their character then comes to the fore. They're not as hungry. They've made it. And then they turn into great philanthropists and community leaders, and you see that again and again. And I have some friends who are actually that way, a venture capitalist, as well as this gentleman I was telling you about, the private equity guy, who are marvelous characters. But just as a group, if you're talking to a young finance person, they tend to be singularly focused on just money and not these other issues.
Very interesting. Here's a question from the audience. Can you talk about some of the mental or social rituals or exercises that stand out amongst these marvelous individuals? And are there any that we may take away and apply in our own lives?
They're very family focused. Very family focused. One of these very successful individuals said to me once, "I don't do dinner meetings." And he moved to San Francisco about 15 years ago, and he said, "I can count on one hand when I did a dinner meeting. I'm always at home at 6:30 with my kids." I don't know about rituals, but I will. One of the traits is that they prize their privacy and they're very comfortable being alone. They like their solitude. Really marvelous characters know themselves, and they take time away from everyone and everything to check in with themselves, to understand what their feelings are. We all have issues that are bubbling up in the back of our minds, the four-fifths of our brain that we are not cognitively aware of. And that's where the playful part of our beings are. That's where the creative part of our beings are. That's where the emotional part of our beings springs from. And somehow, intuitively, they're aware that they need to take time for that. So Maslow talked about this a little bit. Joseph Campbell, who was the great professor of comparative religion from Sarah Lawrence. How many of you heard of Joseph Campbell, The Power of Myth? Incredible mind. He said that all of us should have a sacred place, and it may just be a closet where you've got some little shrine or a great photograph of some mountain or someone you lost and loved. Who knows what it is? And you take time every day to clear your mind, the chattering mind that we all are subject to because our world demands this analytical push, push, push to make a living. You need to shut that off every day, find that moment, and just... For lack of a better word, meditate. I do it through exercise. I live in the country now. Here I was an anchor in CNN, living in New York City, in Washington, D.C., White House correspondent, Capitol Hill correspondent. I now live on the side of a mountain. So wild that a cougar the size of a St. Bernard came through my front yard 2 months ago and took a deer down. The only reason I knew he was there is I heard the deer screaming. But to me, that's where I disengage. And these characters do that. Some of them do it in wild ways that the rest of us wouldn't. There was one entrepreneur I interviewed, I can't remember, an Israeli, and he said, "Oh, I've learned how to fly fighter jets." I said, "What?" And he goes, "That's how I relax. I've been trained. Now I go up in a fighter jet." Well, you know, it's interesting. We laugh, but the focus that's required so that you can't be thinking about business and the next quarter's results and all the issues that you have to deal with on a day-to-day basis, you have to focus on flying that jet. So there's different ways we do it, but maybe that answers the question.
Very good. Here's a question from the audience. How are women different in their successful lives? And to expand, did you find any differentiation between the sexes when you began your study or completed your study?
I've interviewed far more men than women, I have to admit. But on these traits, I didn't find that much that's different. Women, of course, are very often pulled away from professional lives because they're very often the nucleus of their family, more often than men. You know, they're charged with the home front. They have to take care of things. Shelley Lazarus, I mentioned her earlier in the discussion, she says this to all these young women. She goes and speaks to these women's colleges and others, and she says, you can't have it all. What you can do is focus on what you love. Really understand what you want to do day to day with your work, if you're going to have a career. And if you love it, you'll find time for it. Because you're going to love your husband, your partner. You're going to love your children. You're going to have to take care of these other things. You better love what you've chosen as a career, because otherwise you're not going to have time for it. So it's this magnificent message. Maslow said that really marvelous people don't sacrifice themselves needlessly. Listen to her message. Do what you love, and then you'll have time for it. You'll have energy for it. So women, I suppose, in some respects, bring a little more of that about the balance of work and home and parenting, etc.
There are three questions here that are nearly identical, and they all refer to the current political situation. In the context of our current political and economic mess, do you see any current leaders who could exercise enough good leadership to lead us out from our great problems? Or have you analyzed the current political leaders through the lens of these 19 traits and detected any standouts?
You know, the first time I heard Barack Obama, he was on 60 Minutes being interviewed by Steve Croft. And I had a friend over for dinner or something, and we were discussing something. And as soon as I heard Obama speak, I said to my friend, stop. And he was a little offended. And I said, no, I want to. I said, listen to this guy. And he said, what do you mean? I said, he's marvelously healthy as a psyche. And actually, a number of psychologists have written about Obama saying, yes, he is. And he was at a fundraiser in the city I was lucky enough to go to, and I got a question in, you know, from my White House days. I'm one of those people who can get, I get my question answered. My question was, how did you have such a calm personality? How did you develop this even-keel demeanor? And he said, what's this thing the Hawaiians do? He made this move with his finger and his thumb, and he said, oh, you know, hang ten, you know.
Shaka.
It's all about Hawaii. He sort of brushed it off. But imagine someone his age, he's now younger than I am, running the country, going after Osama bin Laden, dealing with the economic financial crisis that he walked into, and he's calm and cool. Now, if you ask me how he's doing as a president, I wouldn't give him a very good grade. I wish that the other side, and for anyone listening out there, I'm no raving liberal, San Francisco liberal. I voted for more Republicans than I have Democrats. But I don't think the Republicans are meeting him halfway. I don't think they're even meeting him three quarters of the way on the budget situation. And I covered the budget politics for 11 years. I know exactly how that works. And so we've got a standoff. We've got a power play going on right now. And as healthy as Barack Obama is, he is not, maybe not up to the task of getting the kind of major overhaul in entitlement programs and the tax code that we need. And both sides have to be more flexible. But I think we're too close to an election. So to the answer to the question, I'm afraid, is I don't think we're going to get any great leadership or resolution to this stuff until after the 2012 elections.
Well, moving from the sublime to the ridiculous, I was surprised, Donald, just got to say this, that to see that you address the topic of breaking wind so early in the book. Most authors leave that for the later chapters.
Well, Steve, you're embarrassing me a little bit. But there, in chapter one, this is being autonomous. One of the things that Maslow discusses is that really marvelous people are very good animals. I mean, this is at a visceral level. And they are not ashamed or have guilt about their bodies or bodily functions. And I tell a funny story about an old friend of mine who's now in his 80s, passing around this Scientific American or Medical Journal story about how gas is actually a sign of a good diet and good health. And this was very funny to me as a teenager. I was 15 at the time. But it struck me because my household was so kind of shut down on those issues. And this family had always been competitive and rambunctious and good eaters, and they were good animals. So that's important to understand. If you're going to be autonomous, you have to accept yourself at the bodily level. So I tell that story because it brings it home to people, and clearly it did to you.
It did. I was also surprised to see that you, Donald Vandermark, a television reporter, program creator and editor, internet entrepreneur, recommends that in your book that people turn off their media every evening and they take a week-long holiday from the news at least once a year.
Well,
explain to me.
To be more precise, Andrew Weil, the famous holistic medicine pioneer who lives in Arizona, he says that everyone should take a vacation from the media every year, at least a week. It's like a shower, a long cleansing shower for your spirit. Because you have to understand that the market, the media, these are some of the most cleverest people in the world in terms of communicating ideas, not just what to buy, what deodorant to buy, for heaven's sakes, or what truck, but ideas about who you're supposed to be. All these characters that come at us in the posters, in the televisions, in the grocery store now. We can't escape it. They're all selling an image of who you're supposed to be. You're supposed to be you. And then it was Stephen Covey who said that every night he turns off the phones at 7 p.m. because it's dinner time with his family. And he makes this very profound distinction in his book about what's urgent and what's important. And there are a lot of things in our lives that are urgent, like the cell phone ringing or the text messaging coming through, that aren't important. And there is a point every day that we should all shut that off. And again, yes, I'm a creature of the media, but there are limits to its value. One of my best friends says the television is an open sewer into your living room. I wouldn't go that far because there are some good shows. But a lot of it, yes. Shut it off. You'll be happier for it.
That's very interesting. Donald, there's a contradiction that I detected in the book in our common understanding of what ambition is, and then your image of these great people who, and I'm quoting now, are compellingly modest with, quote, quiet natures who, quote, turn up to do some significant job and then disappear without a word. And yet, so you've got these ambitious people who you claim are eager to fade into the background at the first opportunity. And yet many of the people that you highlight, Meryl Streep and Bill Bradley and Warren Buffett, are obviously public figures. So could you talk about that seeming contradiction?
You never see Meryl Streep on a tabloid. She does not grant interviews except when she's forced to promote a movie. You don't know that she has four children or the names of those children or the name of her husband, who's a guy named Don Gummer. He's a sculptor. She does not use these people as her appendages. Charlie Munger does not get on the talk shows constantly. Warren Buffett actually has disappointed me because in the last few years, he has become much more public. He wasn't for years. The only time you ever heard from Warren Buffett was his annual meeting, the Woodstock for Capitalists. He'd pop up once a year, try and educate the rest of us about finance and reality, and then go away. Well, he's become more prominent. And the only reason I can give it is there are these attractive young women interviewers who get him to come on television more often. But the really marvelous, you don't see Charles Schwab, you know, gallivanting around town. I mean, most of these characters, yes, they happen to be very prominent because they are very, very successful and they choose leadership roles. But you don't see them in other realms. You see them there. And often when they finish a job, they disappear.
Interesting. You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. Our speaker today is Donald VanDeMark, author of The Good Among the Great, who is discussing the personality traits shared by super high achievers that allow them to remain great human beings as well. Donald, you say in the book that life itself is moral and that karma amongst human beings is real. And yet you talk in the book about times when you've acted not so morally and when many, many others haven't, and I think all of us have acted immorally from time to time. So where does the moral compass come from, and how does that dovetail with these 18 or 19 traits?
There's a lot of great research going on now about morality among human beings and how it may indeed be inborn. You know, we've thought of it as a social construct. In order to benefit ourselves, we treat others well because it will come back to us. That's the karma notion. But actually, the newest research is that it's inborn, and that that they've done tests with little tiny children before they've had much in the way of socialization, infants, and they will behave in a moral fashion. But setting that aside, I have behaved immorally. Most of us have at one time or another in our lives. Recognizing that and forgiving yourself is part of the self-acceptance that goes into being an autonomous, self-accepting, self-directed human being. So here's one aspect of one trait playing into another trait. Now, what was the first part of the question about morality?
Well, you spoke about life itself is moral and that
right.
Karma among human beings is real.
That quote doesn't come from me. It comes from a now deceased, marvelous preacher named R. Morris Boyd, Protestant Irishman, who preached at the City Church in New York City. I used to go regularly. I'm not much of a churchgoer, to be honest with you. But here was a gentleman who was so bright and so captivating and took everyday issues we all faced and brought a spiritual and religious context to it all. One of his great sermon themes was that life itself is moral, that how you behave will come back to you. There will be repercussions for every falsehood you tell, every person you wrong or malign. And we all know that. We all know that you can easily create an enemy if you cheat someone. Warren Buffett and Charlie Munger talk endlessly, particularly Charlie, on this issue of ethics and morality. One of my good friends knows one of his daughters and asked, he's sort of a fan of Warren and Charlie, and he said, "What did Charlie talk about when you were kids around the dinner table?" She said, "You know, the thing he harped on most of all was honesty and morality." And Charlie Munger was talking a lot about the financial crisis and about how the salesman who wanted a second pair of alligator loafers will sell you down the river, about how capable a lot of these salespeople are and the tactics they have in terms of overselling to a over-consuming public. But this question of morality and the karma and how it comes back to you, it's embodied in one word, and that is reputation. The reputation, your reputation, is like a bank account, and you make deposits all the time when you're treating people fairly, when you're behaving properly, when you're doing the right thing. And you can wipe that bank account out with one bad move and ruin your reputation. And Warren Buffett and Charlie Munger talk constantly about the fact that if someone wrongs them, they will no longer be part of their circle. And I've seen that among my most capable friends and the people I admire most. You just need to wrong them once. There's not going to be a retribution except that you'll just be shut off. This is one of the traits Maslow talked about, actually, that I don't go into great depth in the book, is that really capable, marvelous people can come across as ruthless. because they see things more clearly than the rest of us, and they really don't waste time on people who can and who have cheated them or wronged them. It's just move on. And that's a good lesson for the rest of us to learn.
You extol, in particular, Meryl Streep in your book as seemingly crossing off all of the boxes.
Well, the reason why, I don't know if any of you remember, I think it was December 2009, Vanity Fair had a cover story with Meryl Streep. And the gist of the article, the piece, as we would call it in the news business, the lead was that she, a 60-year-old woman, was a box office kingpin. This had never happened. It's usually men. It's usually younger men. It's usually action movie heroes. And so here was Meryl Streep, had a string of hits. How did she do it? And then the story goes along, and you hear from all of these directors and producers and fellow actors and others who've worked with her, extolling her virtues. And in that one article, you could see the traits, either described by a director or by a fellow actor or a childhood friend or someone who'd worked on a charity thing with her. There they all were. So I went online looking up Meryl Streep, and there actually is a website that is run by her management company, which is all her stuff, the interviews that she's given, a lot of them overseas, which we've never seen, and some of the commencement addresses she's given to various schools, and even some of the remarks she's made on award shows. And when you hear her voice and hear her describe different things that matter, there are the traits. Being empathic, or empathetic, both words are correct. Having empathy for others. Being experiential. Remember, her first two big movies were French Lieutenant's Woman and Kramer versus Kramer. And so she was then asked to do all these roles where she's the tortured victim in the high drama role. She said, I want to be in another time, in another place. I want to do comedy. I want to be completely different. That's the experiential person. No. I don't. There's more to life. Being autonomous. She talks on these commencement addresses. She talks to these students and she says, don't give in to the great chewing complacency. What a marvelous phrase, first of all. But go out there every day and give your best. Don't give in to this great chewing complacency. This is an extraordinary human being talking, not just a great actress.
Mm-hmm. Is she aware that she's the last chapter in your book?
She is, but I've never heard from her.
Interesting.
And the other reason she's in this book, besides that Vanity Fair article and then my search online, a friend of mine named Annie Carter, who lives in New York, one of her best friends is Meryl Streep's sister-in-law. And so I sent the manuscript to Annie 2 years ago, because she's a bit of a writer and whatnot, and she read it, and she came back to me with some ideas. And she said, you know, Donald, the person you're describing reminds me of Meryl Streep. And I said, really? Why? And she goes, well, you know, she's such a great actress and such a great person, and my friend Mary, I'll remember Mary's last name in a second, but Mary is married to Meryl Streep's younger brother, Dana Streep, so her married name is Mary Streep. But she said, you know, at every family gathering, she's the first person to help with the dishes, and she's the best aunt to my kids. And I said to Annie, well, that's worth all the Academy Awards to me. And that gives you an idea. In her private world, she is as good as this public persona that we know.
Are there any other people that come to mind that come close to checking off the 18 boxes?
Well, Andrew Weil, you know, he's the great bearded, bald, holistic medicine pioneer. I went out to his ranch in Arizona, and one of the things that struck me, and we're walking around before we even sit down to do the interview, I said, you're from Philadelphia, aren't you, Dr. Weil? Oh, yes, yes. I said, and then you went to Harvard. Oh, yeah, yes. And you went to graduate school, Harvard Medical School. Yes. You're really an East Coast guy. He goes, oh, my whole family's from the East Coast. I said, how did you end up here? He said, well, I was coming back from Central America after studying these shamans and all of these different medicines that they have. You know, he's a trained botanist as well. And he said, I was in a Land Rover, and it was 1981, and I broke down here in Tucson. And he said, there was no Land Rover dealership then, and I had to wait a week to get the part. And he said, you know, I was here for 5 or 6 days, and I realized this suits me. I really like it. And I said, so you picked up your whole life and just moved here? He said, yeah. And I said, you know, most of the rest of us don't do that. He said, you know, we ought to. There's a synchronicity to life, to the universe. And if you follow those clues, this is Andrew Weil talking, if you follow those clues, you will become of greater use to the world. Greater use? I thought it was selfish. No. He's talking about this autonomous digging deep. Now listen, sometimes people will accuse me of, oh, this is New Age stuff, and Andrew Weil, come on, you know what? William James, America's great first psychologist, one of America's great philosophers, said, man need but obey himself. He who is true to himself, something I'm paraphrasing, will become part of destiny. That's what Andrew Weil is telling you. If you are who you are meant to be, take the time out every day and listen hard and then craft your life, you can become part of something much bigger.
Very interesting. We are approaching the point in our program where we have time for one last question. And so I'm going to ask you to talk about this idea that's in the first chapter about being autonomous, wherein you discuss how people will often chase jobs around the country, and you conclude in the book that perhaps that's not the best strategy.
Well, again, Jim Barksdale is the one who came to that conclusion. He's the guy who helped launch Netscape. He is the one who helped build FedEx. He's a great CEO. I interviewed him out here when we were talking about entrepreneurs and funding entrepreneurs. And he was a great guy, open, like so many of these characters are. And I said to him at one point, it was really a very personal question I was asking. I said, should the ambitious young person go where the great jobs are? Or should they go where they want to live and hope that they find a good job? Oh, that one's easy, he said. You live where you want to live. I said, no, I'm talking about the ambitious young person. That person should go where the jobs are, right? He said, oh, no, there are good jobs everywhere. First and foremost, you have to be where you want to be. And then he started talking about the fact that he and his wife had moved to Colorado because their kids love the outdoors and the mountains and all that, and that he was crafting this life now as a venture capitalist from Colorado. That struck me like a thunderbolt, just like Andrew Weil saying he moved here because it suited him. These characters lead their own lives, and they're trying to tell us that we need to as well.
There is one last question that came from the audience, and that is, what lake in Canada?
Do you know, I don't say it, and it's the reason is because none of my friends up there want it publicized. This gets back to this issue of privacy. Really marvelous people are discreet by nature. And they are discreet and private for so many reasons. One is, when you're out in the public realm, you become the subject of attacks and envy at the very least. And so much of life ought to be left unsaid. So I don't mention the specific lake, but it is in southern Ontario, north of Toronto, a couple hours north. There are actually hundreds of lakes there. And so, and all the Torontonians, and then also lots of people from Pennsylvania and Ohio and upstate New York all go up there to fish, and they've done it for generations. There's this great exchange of Canadians and Americans every summer. And so just go there sometime, and that wondrous lake will appear to you.
All right. So our good thanks to Donald Vandermark, author of The Good Among the Great. We also thank our audiences here and on radio, television, and the internet. I'm Stephen Falk, City Manager of Lafayette, California, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know, is adjourned.